Hi, everybody. My name is Larsine. I'm a very, very grateful member of Al-Anon. I want to thank Demetrius for that absolutely excellent talk that he just gave. You already got your money's worth. So that was really, really good. So thank you. Thank you for that. I want to thank Diane for asking me to be here under the circumstances that they were. You know, it's always sad when we lose somebody. I didn't know Gordon really well, but I'd like to think that that he's here in the room with us. And I ate his food, and I'm sleeping in his room, and I have boobs, so I, you know, it's a different deal. But I just want to, you know, just have a moment, just to, if you could just think for him, about him for just a moment. Alrighty, thank you. Okay, so anyway, like I said, I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. It's a little bit hard for me to be here because I know so many of you. You know, this is like talking in your own backyard. So hopefully I've always told the truth. Come back to me now, right? But it is an honor and a privilege to get to be here. When I say I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, I remember when I first came to meetings, God, I thought that was just the most gross thing that people would say in the world. How can you possibly be grateful? You know, but I'm here to tell you, you know, that in, you know, the 41 years that I've now been in Al-Anon, that I am truly, truly a grateful member of Al-Anon. And if you're not yet, keep coming back. And it will happen because I am the most stubborn person in the universe. And if it happened for me, it will definitely happen for you. And I want it to happen for you because you will have a life beyond your wildest dreams. Nothing I ever imagined even compares to what's going on in my life today. You know, and that's because of the friendships and the people that I've gotten to know in this program. And what you do day after day after day is you give me the shot at a good life. And I am so, so grateful for that. But I'm the person that's got to take the shot. And it's not anybody else's responsibility to do that but me. So I'm going to launch into this really, really quick because we have many, many baskets to raffle. I know that's really important. And I'm not going to screw that up for nothing. So, you know, I'm the oldest child in my family. My dad was a master sergeant in the Army. We've always been in the military. So being the oldest, I've always had rank. I'm always at least a corporal, if nothing else. And, you know, and I gravitate to buildings that say headquarters. You know, I just love that stuff. My husband jokes that I came out of the womb carrying a clipboard and wearing an armband. And he's not too far off the mark. When I was in school, I was always room monitor, cafeteria monitor, playground monitor. And why? Because the teacher knew if anybody did anything wrong, I would write them down and report them. It's just a gift I have. It's a gift I still have. I consider it a gift from God, and I do plan on using it as often as I can. But it's just who I am. It's just, again, and I don't know where all of that comes from and the alcoholism and all the other kind of stuff that goes around with that. But, you know, my dad was an alcoholic. I had no idea my dad was an alcoholic. It's not like you're born and you get a brochure and says, hey, your dad's an alcoholic, so this will explain a lot. You know, I don't know that. I don't know that as a little kid. All I know as a little kid growing up is my dad's a mean guy. And I don't know why he's a mean guy. I used to wonder as a little kid why anybody would go to all the trouble to marry someone and then have children and just to be mean to them and make them feel bad about who they are. I don't know that. I don't know that my dad has a problem drinking because my dad drinks every day. My dad gets drunk every day. To me, that's normal. That's just what dads do. And we were always living in other military housing. So let me tell you, back in the 50s and early 60s, there were lots of moms walking around with broken arms and black eyes, and no one ever said or did a darn thing about it. It's just the way that it was. And so it was my normal life. I never attributed, you know, that to my dad's drinking. And, you know, and then just to kind of, you know, fast forward through all of that, all I learned early on is, he's the Sarge and you do what the Sarge says. You know, we used to have little foot lockers at the end of our bunk beds and in our room, and my dad would do room inspection. I remember being 3 and 4 years old, standing there waiting, my dad bouncing quarters off my bed and white gloving it, and me standing there at attention waiting for the salute. You know, and the reason we had all that stuff is because my dad stole all of it from the Army, because, you know, when you're a sergeant in the Army, you don't make a lot of money. And again, I had no idea any of this stuff was going on. It's just kind of what I learned. Do what the Sarge tells you to do. Do it to the best of your ability. Don't mess up. And, you know, and you might get away with not getting hit that day. Just the way that it was in the house that we grew up in. And when I was new in Al-Anon, I went to lots of open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't recommend that enough. If you're new here, you know, it says in our Al-Anon literature that we should learn all we can about the disease of alcoholism. And I know but no better place to learn that than in open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember one of the first meetings I went to, the AA speaker that night, he spoke about alcoholism, the family disease. And he described alcoholism, the family disease, as like having a rhinoceros in your living room, but everybody pretends it's a coffee table. And boy, if I can describe the house that I grew up in, that's the house that I grew up in, because we never talked about nothing. If you grew up in an alcoholic home, you know the first thing that goes out of the window was any kind of verbal communication whatsoever. And, you know, so we'd be at the dinner table and my mom could never say to us girls, hey, nobody talk, nobody do anything, your dad's going to blow, because my dad blew every night anyway. But my mom would speak to us facially. And if you're at the dinner table and your mom's doing the shaky head, and, you know, if you know, if you grew up in that, you know exactly what that means. Don't talk, don't move, don't do anything. But, you know, you've got kids at the table, someone's going to scrape a knife on a plate or spill a little bit of milk, some minor infraction. My dad's going to go ballistic. Dinner's going to go flying. Everybody's going to get a beating. Everybody's got to go to bed at 5:30. My mom, the kids, the dog. It's the way it goes down in our house. And I remember the next morning creeping down the hallway to go in the kitchen to have breakfast before I went to school. And there'd be my dad drinking his breakfast beer. And it would just be, good morning, what do you want for breakfast? No one ever said, gee whiz, what was that about last night, Dad? Gee whiz, how come you had to hit everybody? How come you had to break everything? Because in our house, day after day after day, that rhinoceros just went back to being a coffee table. And that's the house that I grew up in. You know, and just to kind of fast forward through that, you know, I'm going to let you know that my dad ended up dying. He died when he was 55 years old. You know, he died the death that they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, total insanity and death. I can't even tell you the last words my dad said to me because they were so vile and so vulgar, I wouldn't even begin to repeat them from this podium, and it's not necessary. You know, and I always say the last words my dad said to me, when in reality what I know today is those were the last words my dad's alcoholism said to me before they took the life of yet one more person, because that's the whole goal of the disease. And not only was it not enough for the disease to take the life of a person, it wanted to spit out the last ugly words that it could to the family. How we are affected by the disease of alcoholism. And I say how we are affected by the disease of alcoholism because when my dad died, my mom had long since divorced him. I'm the oldest. I had the power of attorney and all that stuff. My sisters are in the hallway. And then when the doctor came out and tell us that my dad had finally passed, my sisters and I were not sad. We were like, ding dong, the witch is dead, da da da. And I don't tell you this story because I'm proud of it. I tell you this story that this is where I believe the family disease of alcoholism will take a family. That it'll be happy to see, you know, that you would be happy to see someone die than live in that reign of terror one more day. And that's just what we thought. And what my sisters and I also thought that day was that that reign of terror was over because the alcoholic had died. And what I got to find out from my own experience and my sisters as well is that the only thing that happened that day was that the alcoholic died, but that the family disease of alcoholism was alive and well in me and my family and how we had been affected by that. Because at this point, I had started coming to Al-Anon. I'd been coming to Al-Anon. I started Al-Anon in June of 1981. My dad died October, Friday the 13th. That's the day my dad would pick anyway. You know, and that's the, you know, so June to October, I'd only been coming to Al-Anon for a little bit of time. I was hardly into any kind of loving forgiveness. You know, I wasn't doing any of that stuff yet. I almost said crap because that's what I thought it was at the time. And I was working the program to the best of my ability. I had a sponsor, I had a home group, I was going to meetings, I was doing what all the things that I thought that I should be doing. But boy, I was angry. I was still so angry. And boy, if I'd be anywhere and someone even so much as had a tone in their voice when they talked to me that even began to resemble my dad. And my dad had a tone. He was a master sergeant in the Army. Let me tell you, he could dress you down pretty darn good. But anybody would talk to me in that tone, and boy, the hair on the back of my neck would go up, and I would just get so pissed off. And I don't know how you guys are, but when I'm really angry, I like to take that home and share it with my husband and my children and, you know, the people that I love and care about the most, because isn't that the family disease of alcoholism? And boy, if you can get the neighbors involved, extra points for you. I mean, isn't it all about the drama? How much drama can we drive up from all of this crap? And I'm going to meetings and I don't want to be doing this. I don't want to be doing this. And I remember going to my first sponsor, who's Jeannie. I had her for the first 9 years I was in Al-Anon until she passed away. Just a great little gal. And she's a little tiny short Dutch woman with a big thick Dutch accent. You could hardly understand a bloody word she said until you asked her to be your sponsor. And then all of a sudden everything's crystal clear. But at the time, She was really, really hard. And I told her, you know, and I was always angry, always feisty. Al-Anon doesn't work. This sucks. I'm still angry. I'm still yelling at and hitting my kids. You know, when is this going to stop? Al-Anon doesn't work. You know, what am I doing wrong? And I remember her telling me, you're not doing anything wrong except for one thing, Larcy. You're focused on the problem. That's all you ever look at is the problem. And Al-Anon isn't about the problem. Al-Anon is about the solution. You know, so she gave me an assignment, and she always prefaced, you know, that I wasn't going to like it, because I've never liked one weeny stupid thing they have ever told me to do in Al-Anon. I've never been a willing, oh, yes, sign me up. I can't wait to write an inventory. You know, no. You know, but at any rate, she says, I'm going to give you an assignment. You're not going to like it. And my assignment was that I was supposed to go home and think of a good thing my dad had done. And my absolute initial reaction is, you are out of your flaming mind. You know, you want me to think up a good thing my dad has done when my very first remembrance of being alive is fear at my father's hands. That's my first memory. And you want me to think up something good my dad did for me? You know, and I remember Jeannie just as what she, you know, I'm not going to do it. And I remember her saying, you know, Larcine, I've never made you do anything. She says, all I've ever asked you to do, all Al-Anon ever asked you to do is just to be willing. And I remember going to one of those first meetings, and I heard someone say at the meeting that if you're not willing to do something different, how can you possibly expect anything to be different? And for whatever reason, that made sense to me, so I've always been willing. Mind you, it's just this much willingness, because that's just how pigheaded and stubborn I am. But I'm here to tell you, I believe this program to be so powerful that you only need this much willingness, but you do have to have some. And I don't know how long it was, a week or two. I remembered that my dad taught me how to drive. And if you're going to live in Southern California, marry an alcoholic of your own and track that sucker down. It's just a skill you got to have, okay? And I'm talking about tracking alcoholics down. No cell phones, no GPS. We didn't have any of that good stuff at all. Just had to go in a car, find people who don't want to be found. And apparently we're really better at it than we give ourselves credit for, but at any rate, that was the only thing I could literally think of. And I remember going to Jeannie, you know, thinking she's not going to be happy with this answer. And I, you know, so I thought up a good thing my dad had done for me. And, oh, Jeannie was a clapper. Whenever I did good, she's like, ooh, you know, because that hardly ever happened. And she was, and I think, well, she's not going to be happy when I tell her what my answer is. I said, well, he taught me how to drive. Well, now she was ecstatic, you know, But see, in all defense to me, it was my rookie year in Al-Anon. So I didn't know that once your sponsor gave you an assignment, there would be part two, you know. And part two is the action that we take. That's what the love is about in the program. It's the action. That's what love is. It's not our feelings. It's the action that we take. And then she said to me, now, whenever you think about some humiliation or embarrassment, you know, and I am always, always willing to tell alcoholics, you know, that if you've ever been at a school function and you're getting an award, you have a drunken father show up, then pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization isn't just reserved for the alcoholic. And my dad was really big at all those things. And she says, so whenever you think about any of those experiences or a beating you took or whatever, she goes, I just want you to replace that negative thought with this positive one. And then she says, and I also want you to think about your dad dying. You know, and that, you know, not only did your dad die from the disease of alcoholism at 55 years old, he also died with all of his children being grateful he was dead. And you're a parent, you have children. Would you want that to happen to you? Do you think your dad really wanted that to happen to him? Or maybe, just maybe, can you accept the fact that he was a sick alcoholic, and not only did he pay the price of his life, but he also paid the price of having his children being grateful he was dead? And do you need to punish anybody more than that? Did you ever consider that maybe, just maybe, your dad loved you as much as his alcoholism would allow him to? Can you really ask people to love you more than they are capable of doing? You know, and see, these are things that never, ever passed through my mind. You know, it was just always, he was the bad guy, he was the mean guy, and he must be punished. You know, but again, I come to Al-Anon, and you just show me a different way to look at things that never occurred to me. You know, and I don't believe that my dad died and wanted his children to hate him. I believe that's the effect of the disease of alcoholism. That's what happens here. You know, and I don't mean to say that I grew up in this hellacious family, you know, with this dad that beat us regularly and made us feel bad about being girls and all this other kind of crapola. And then I went to my sponsor and I did this stupid weenie assignment, and now it's rainbows and butterflies out my butt. You know, that is not what happens here. You know, what my sponsor gave me that day is one of the most precious gifts I think that we get here, and that's the gift of forgiveness. You know, and it says in our literature, forgiveness is no favor. We do it for nobody but ourselves. Because, see, I thought if I was letting my dad off the hook, you know, I wasn't going to let him off the hook because it wasn't right. You know, and Al-Anon has never once told me that it was right. Al-Anon has just told me that this is what the disease of alcoholism looks like. You want to live in the hatred. You want to live in the anger. You want to live in the resentment. You know, and I always say justifiable anger is just as deadly to the Al-Anon as the first drink is to the alcoholic, because I will run with that and I will run my life into the ground and yours along with me. And I'm not the drinker here. How I am affected by the disease of alcoholism. You know, when my dad did die, you know, he, like I said, I was the oldest. So I remember the military comes, they bring me his ashes, they bring me the flag and all that stuff, and they leave. I happened to be alone that day. And so I had my dad's ashes. So I went downstairs to where our garage is. Behind our garage was our laundry room. So I sat my dad behind the washing machine and I said, "You sit here and you think about what you did." And and it was, you know, every time I went down to do the laundry, I'd go, "Hey, Sarge, guess who's in charge now, Sarge?" And every so often I'd pick up the box and shake the crap out of it. "Here, how do you like it?" And it was all sponsor approved, you know, because it's a process. And then my sister ended up rescuing my dad from me. And my dad in his drunken always would always say, "Hey, you know, when I die, I want you girls to bury my ashes in a tree so my grandsons, you know, can play on the branches," because my dad always, you know, wanted boys, and he got grandsons because he always gets what he wants anyway. And so anyway I think after 2 weeks the tree died. You know, my sister did all that. And so my sister in her illness drank, you know, tried to dig up my dad to the best of her ability and back in the box. And I think husband number two just found a box that he thought was a box of dirt and took it to the dump. And I know, well, that's only funny here. Do not tell this story at work, okay? Nobody will have lunch with you. I mean, they're just like, "Oh my God." But anyway, I'm going to just race through this. So it was just this house that we grew up in. My dad was just this guy. He was just, and again, how I am affected by the disease of alcoholism. You know, I liken growing up with the disease of alcoholism, living with the disease of alcoholism, is like having a bowl of crap in front of you. And I don't think anybody in this room will eat a bowl of crap in one setting, but I'm here to tell you, you'll choke down a teaspoon every single day if that'll just make it be quiet. Maybe just have some peace in the house or whatever. How I am affected by the disease of alcoholism. And so anyway, when us girls are getting older, you know, we're finally getting to be of a dating age, you know, and it was hard to date in my house because we'd have to bring these weenie boys home to meet my dad. You know, my dad's over 6 foot tall, black hair. He had one eyebrow he could raise 6 inches off at this side of his forehead. And he's a master sergeant. Holy, I mean, you know, he's an intimidating guy. So we'd bring these guys home. My dad would give him the master sergeant interrogation. "Where are you going? When are you going to be back?" And then he would tell them what part of their anatomy he would remove if we were not returned in the virginal condition of which we left the house in the first place. Damn near impossible to get a second date in my house. I mean, you know, guys didn't even make it. One guy, I think, almost peed himself, you know. I mean, it's just the insanity. But the fact that my dad always had a firearm or a hand grenade in his hand never helped matters either. But that was my dad. And see, and I didn't, and me and my sisters and I, we never thought there was anything wrong with that because that's what we grew up with. You know, I love in our literature, you know, where it says, when we know, you know, there's something wrong with the alcoholics drinking and thinking, we still hide what we feel and what we know. That's the insanity, you know, because that was just normal for us. When I was 17, I met Butch. I should have known there was something wrong with him because my dad liked him right away. And that had never, ever happened. And I remember Butch and I went on this date. We were with this other couple, and we went bowling first. And then after that, we were going to go back to his place, and where he was back living with his mom and dad because he'd been married, had a kid before, blah, 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 blah. And but anyway, he stopped at a liquor store and he'd asked me what I wanted to drink. And I was 17 years old. I'm a rule and regulation girl. I am Army raised. And I proceeded to tell him the drinking laws in the state of California, you know, and that I was an underage minor buddy. But I know he didn't hear what I know all he heard was blah, 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 because that's still what he hears when he doesn't want to hear what I'm saying. And he went in and he got a gallon of Red Mountain wine, if nothing else, to impress me with his wine knowledge, whatever. And I don't know nothing about nothing from drinking. But we went back to his house. We're with this other couple. We played this game. It's called Pass Out. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of it or not. It's a legitimate board game. It had rules. I read them. And Now, I don't drink because it's against the law to drink, but there's another rule that's even more important than that, and that's I must win every game I play, okay? Because I'm in the Army. We never surrender. We never give up. You will be victorious. It doesn't matter if you cheat. You know, you will survive. You will raise the flag. You know, in our house, you didn't come home if you were not in first place. And so, so I drank a half a glass of this god-awful wine, and guess who won the game? Because that's what that was all about. And guess who drank all the rest of the wine? You know, and I'm going to tell you what I still remember from that day to this, and that's over 50 years ago now. And what I remember about that night to this day is still what a great time I had, because he was so much fun. Oh my gosh, he just made me laugh. I mean, he was just a hoot. I mean, and I just never had fun with anybody like that. I'd never been with anybody like that. You know, and Butch was old. He was 7 years older than me, so he's like 23. You know, he's a hippie guy. Beard, long hair, tattoos, no underwear. Another clue, they're an alcoholic. I continue to petition Virginia Beach to put that in the frickin' literature. No underwear, alcoholic guaranteed. So just whatever. So I guess two pairs of pants is too much for most of them. I don't know what the deal is about that. But I just had the best time of my life. And I remember going home. And believe you me, at 17, I got a list in my head about what my life is going to be. I can't wait to get out of the house. I mean, you can cut the hate between my mom and a dad with a knife, you know. And I tell you what my list looked like. I'm going to marry somebody who I love, and that person's going to love me back. We're going to have nothing but all girl children, because my dad hated having girl children, you know. And my life is good. And there's going to be no drinking, because at 17, I know my dad's a drunk. I know what the deal is here. You know, but then again, you know, what's he, you know, here's, you know, number one on my list parade, you know, no drinking. Well, holy crap, he just practically drank a whole gallon of wine here. You know, how's this going to work? And this is where I will stand toe to toe with any alcoholic or anybody for that matter when it comes to rationalization and justification. Because, boy, I think up crap all the time. And, you know, my first sponsor, Ginny, always used to tell me, it's information from nowhere, Larstein. It's just floating up here, it lands here, and you act upon it. But that's the house that I grew up in, because you couldn't ask any questions. What's the survival thing? I just think crap up. I have to come up with some kind of an answer, some kind of a solution. You know, and that night it was, how can I go out with him again when he's drinking? Really simple. Lands here. You see, because when my dad's drinking, my dad wants to yell at you and hit you and make you feel bad about who you are. When Butch is drinking, he just wants to hug you and kiss you and tell you how pretty you are. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I can work with that, okay? Because that has only the potential, you know. And from that point on, you know, that Butch and I, you know, we started dating exclusively. It was hard for me to date Butch because he couldn't remember my name. But you can't let a little weenie thing like that stop you from going out with an alcoholic, now can you? And I always like to tell the name story because it's another healing thing with my dad. And that's, you know, so my dad named me Larstein. The way the story got told to me is I was supposed to be a boy. There was no, you know, backup plan for a girl being born. You know, my name was supposed to be Lawrence Edmund Wells Jr., period, that end of story. And so I was born, and the way my dad would tell the story is, you were born, and I was so disappointed. You know, I mean, yeah, it's just like, you know, blah, blah, blah. He was gone for 2 days. He was so mad at my mom. And, you know, but anyway, he says, but because you're firstborn, I named you Larstein, which is the name of a town in Scotland. And he said to me, and to know my dad is to know how proud he was of his Scottish heritage. And he told me I should always be proud of it. I've been told that since the beginning of time. I've always been proud of it. Fast forward, my dad's dead. You know, and so I got curious about Larstein, Scotland. And again, before computers and Googles, you went to buildings called libraries for information. So I go to the library to look up Larstein, Scotland, nothing. So I asked the reference librarian, you know, if she could look up, you know, find out any information on it. What do you know? It's the name of a town in Scotland. That's all I got. I remember going back there 2 weeks later, getting that manila envelope, pulling out this piece of paper. And across it, it says, no such place as Larstein, Scotland. And I am ticked off, people. I have done your freaking forgiveness exercise in Al-Anon, and this is bull crappy. Here he is stabbing me from the grave. You know, I am just getting angrier and angrier. And then we have this friend that goes to Scotland every year, and he says, Larstein, maybe there was like Larstein, Scotland, you know, hundreds of years ago. Let me check it out before you go wackadoodle. So he goes to Scotland. He comes back. No one in Scotland has ever heard of Larstein, Scotland. Well, now I'm going to change my name. Bite me, Dad. I am one pissed off person. And I happened to be at my husband's big AA speaker meeting one night, and this fellow walks up to me and he goes, Larstein, you're not going to believe this, but I found out that Larstein is a Scottish word. I'm like, you are kidding me. He goes, no, Larcine is Scottish, for father was drunk when daughter was born, so daughter got a weird name. And I know the moment that he told me that, that it absolutely positively wasn't true. I'm not an idiot, you know. But what he went on to say to me is, Larcine, you know what? I'm alcoholic, like your dad was alcoholic. And I don't know if he read it wrong, spelt it wrong. I don't know what the heck he did. But I'm here to tell you that I believe that when your dad named you Larcine, he believed it was the name of a town in Scotland. And just because it's not wrapped the way that you want it to be wrapped, does it make it any less of a gift? You know, and then, again, one more time, what happens to me day after day in Al-Anon is you guys just give me the shot at a good life. You know, that never would have occurred to me. I never think of things like that because I've always been the victim here. It's always someone else's fault. That's the deal. It's always someone else's fault. And what we get to learn here is that it doesn't always look that, it may look that way on the outside. But if you really go in, if you do, you take the action, you do the love thing that we're supposed to do here. You know, and it's not like I bought it hook, line, and sinker, but, you know, I went home, and after a couple of days, you know, I didn't believe that my dad would go to all that trouble to hurt me. I don't. I believe he believes it's the name of a town in Scotland. And now I have Larcine. It's on my license plate, 7 letters. It fits perfectly. And a few years ago, my husband got me license plate holders that say it's the name of a town in Scotland. Kidding, I have had 2 total strangers walk up to me and tell me they have been there. You can't up. But anyway, Butch and I dated for a couple of years. Like I say, it was hard. He couldn't remember my name. He knows it pretty well now, but he had a hard time with it. And again, and I'm going to tell you, those 2 years that we were dating, my husband did a lot of drinking and he did a lot of drugs, and he never hid or pretended that he didn't do those things. He was always very upfront about, this is who I am and this is what I do. Yet when I walked into Al-Anon, if you would have said, Larcine, does you know your husband's drinking and doing drugs like that, I would have absolutely denied it. Because again, one more time, how I am affected by the disease of alcoholism. I'm not even the drinker here, and I'm the one that lies. I'm the one that covers up. I'm the one that's doing all these kinds of things. And, you know, and what ended up happening is a couple of years later that Butch and I got, I got pregnant. I'm sure Butch was a willing participant, but at any rate, and then later on when our life got really, really bad behind the drinking and using, I was sure that it was because God was punishing me. And this was a big deal for me. I don't care if it was a big deal for you. In 1974, it was a big, big deal for me. And that's why AFG is always really special, because my first AFG, which was like in 82 then, I guess, there was a bunch of us, all us girls would come, Kathy and Chris and a bunch of us. We came to AFG, we got 2 adjoining hotel rooms, you know, so there was like, and Friday night, whatever, we're up in the room and having the meeting after the meeting. And for whatever reason, I heard them talking about, you know, their deepest, darkest secret. That's what I heard. So when it came around to my turn, I told them my deepest, darkest secret, that I'd had to get married because of I was pregnant. And it turns out 7 of us in the room, 6 of them had to get married because they were pregnant. And we decided the 7th was the sickest because she married an alcoholic and didn't have to. Okay, so I don't know how you get any sicker than that. She's right over there with the blue hair, in case you're wondering. I share this with you because those are the miraculous things that happen here. You know, you're not expecting it. It just comes out of the blue, and there's such a freedom, such a freedom. You know why fellowship is so important? You know why reaching out, you know, when someone's saying something, you know, when they tell you something personal about them, that you can say something about you that you've been hiding and keeping away. And that keeps you out of the sunshine of the spirit. That keeps you out of the action of love. That keeps you in the anger. That keeps you in the resentment. You know, and how grateful I am. That's why this life beyond my wildest dreams is, you know, happening. And I didn't even want it. I didn't even know that I wanted it. So anyway, Butch and I got married, and the day after we got married, I sat him in the kitchen chair and I told him the rules and regulations of the marriage. Dude, this is how it's going down. You will get a babysitter once a month. You can party then. Other than that, you're working. You know, you're bringing home a paycheck. You're giving it to me. Do you understand? He sat in the kitchen chair and, you know, he did this, which I took as affirmative. What I didn't know, he's so drunk and loaded. His head was just doing this beboppy thing. And I know this because day 3 of our marriage, guess who does not come home all night long? Well, this is a huge violation of the rules and regulations that I have sat down. And I am very pleased to stand before you today and tell you that my husband begged for the silent treatment, and he never got it, not even one time. Boy, I was like a little dog when you walk in the room. He jokes that I talk as fast as I do because I only had so much time from when he came home to when he passed out for me to tell him everything it was that he was going to hear, because by God, he was going to hear it. Now, I want you to know, too, that, you know, the driving force behind Butch and I getting married was the birth of this child, absolutely, positively. But I also want you to know that Butch and I got married in a church. We got married in front of a minister, and we were as sincere as any two people are when they get married, that we wanted to love each other and take care of each other and do all of those promises that we make. But what he didn't know and I didn't know that day was it wasn't just he and I that got married. It was also the family disease of alcoholism. And I am here to tell you the family disease of alcoholism doesn't love or cherish anything or anybody. It means to tear your family apart. And it will do so through the alcoholic. There is no doubt about that. But I'm here to testify to you that it will equally do so through the non-drinking person. Because I'm the one, I'm the screamer, I'm the yeller, I'm the one who's always angry, I'm the one who's always pissed off. Butch used to say to me all the time, Larcine, why do you make such a big deal out of everything? Because I grew up in a house, we made a big deal out of everything. We were never solution-oriented. Where's always the problem? Who started it? Who's going to pay for it? Who's going to take the beating? All you're ever looking at is the problem. I don't know anything about the solution. You know, and so anyway, and so I'm not going to get into all the drunkalogue with Butch and all that because I don't have time for that. But you know, he was, in his own description of his alcoholism, is pig. So I'll just let that, you know, let that go right there. It's just what was going on in our life. You know, and I know in the program how we talk about, you know, separating the person from the disease, you know, and I understand the difficulty of that, especially when the disease disguises itself as somebody that I love, you know, but I can't tell you how important that is to be able to do that, because for a long, long time, I thought Butch was drinking at me, you know, Butch was trying to hurt me, Butch was doing that, and I'm telling you, in the years I've been in Al-Anon, I can't tell you how many AA speaker meetings I've been to, hundreds, if not thousands. But I'm here to tell you, I've never heard an alcoholic get up to the podium yet and said, I drank because I wanted to hurt my family. But it looks like that and it feels like that. It looks like that when I need money for formula. We don't have money to pay our rent and he's drinking it all up in one night. It looks like that and it feels like that. Because I don't understand about the compulsion to drink. I don't understand that once he takes a first drink, all the promises are off the table. I don't know that. And all I know how to do is get angrier and madder and just and hurt back. And I think I am totally justified in my behavior over and over and over again. You know, so fast forward, you know, 6 or 7 years into our marriage, my husband got arrested for drunk driving, which is no big deal. He gets arrested all the time for drunk driving because back in the 70s, you just paid a lawyer $500 and got reduced to reckless and on you go with your life. You know, but this particular time he had a spiritual awakening and he ended up going into this hospital program. And I'm very, very happy to tell you my husband has been sober this whole entire time. His sobriety date is July the 21st, 1979. So he's 44 years coming up on. I tell you, I'm really, really grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm really, really grateful, not because they saved his life, because I really wanted him to be dead. You know, someone said, why didn't you divorce him and let him win? No, that's not going to happen, people. He's going out feet first. I get to be a young widow with two little kids. That's a good story. But not only, you know, but I am so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous because not only did they save the life of a good person, you know, I think they saved the life of a family as well. Because I want you to think, if my husband had died and my wish had come true, I want you to think about this angry, angry woman raising those two little kids, and I want you to think what kind of family we would be today without the alcoholic. How we are affected by the disease of alcohol. I can't tell you how important it is to be able to look at that. You can't do anything about it until you start looking at that. You know, so Butch got sober, and you know how when they get sober, they're like freaking Superman right out of the gate, you know, like, I'm sober now, whoopee-doo. And, you know, they want the checkbook, all kinds of crap. You know, but when Butch went in this program, they just told me I should go to Al-Anon. Well, I'd already been to Al-Anon. I went to Al-Anon like a year before my husband got sober, you know. And they didn't have any of the great, you know, they had all that great literature, but not the piece I'm interested in is how do you, you know, how to get your husband to drink like you want him to drink. You know, I just want him to behave. And that was my Al-Anon career there, you know. Yet if that at that meeting, they would have said, Larcine, do you want your life to be different? Oh, my God, do I want my life to be different? What are you willing to do about it? Nothing, because it's not my fault. It's not my fault, you know. So now when Butch is sober, they say, well, you need to go to Al, you know, you should go to an Al-Anon meeting. I already been, I knew it didn't work. So I went back to that same Al-Anon meeting. Your newcomer raised my hand. I said, you know, I was here about a year ago, and you didn't tell me how to get my husband sober, and I'm not going to tell you how I got him sober now, because that's just really what I thought had happened there. And you know what they said to me at that meeting? They said, keep coming back. I'm here to tell you. So if you're ever at a meeting and you share some stuff and they say, keep coming back, it's because you said the most asinine, BS, crapola. It's your only hope until your head pops out of your ass. That's all they got for you, you know? They just got to keep coming back until, you know, that's the one thing I missed on Zoom is hearing that pop sound at the meetings, because nothing is better than being at a meeting and seeing somebody finally get it. You know, they may be, you know, the alcoholics may be the reason that a lot of stuff happens, but we're the reason that our life sucks. Okay, don't kid yourself on that. Because alcoholism, the disease, doesn't want you to think you have choices. And you always have choices. I had to come to Al-Anon to find out that I had choices. So anyway, what ended up happening is Butch is sober, happy guy, you know, doing a great job, you know, and bringing the program home. I can't thank AA enough for telling him to do that. And 2 years into my husband's sobriety, I'm going to tell you I'm as angry as I've ever been in my life. And no one was more shocked than that, because I was just so sure that once he got sober, I would be okay. Once he's a good husband, once he's a good father, once he's a good provider, that all those things would fix me. Because I didn't know happiness was an inside job. I didn't know the responsibility to fix Larsine was inside of Larsine. I didn't know that. And one day I'm doing the laundry and he's with the boys and they're cutting up in the living room. And I remember, you know, I'm coming through because the motto in my house is there is no fun until the chores are done. And as I step into the living room, you know, it's dead silence because that's my gift to this family. I suck the joy right out of the room because I just ride them. I ride them so hard. And I remember walking through there and I heard God's voice in my head. And what I heard God say to me is, Larsine, you've become your dad. And even though I was an alcoholic like my dad, boy, I was just trying to rule them with intimidation, making them feel bad about who they were. It's my only tools that I have, you know. And I don't think you get a message like that, that you don't get a solution. Because then the next thing I heard is, this isn't who you are supposed to be. And I knew that it was true, you know. And that's when I started coming to Al-Anon. I didn't come to get an alcoholic sober or keep him sober. I came because I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I remember the first time I got a sponsor right away. And I remember the first time, because I'm a rule follower. What do? You go to meetings, you get a sponsor, you get a home group. I'm all over it, reading the literature, doing all this stuff. And the first time I used Jeannie as a sponsor, actually, Butch had a dead battery that morning. And he asked me to jump it, and I did. And he ran out of gas. And that made him mad, so he started yelling and screaming. And so I started yelling and screaming right back at him. He went to work. I went upstairs, called my sponsor, and reported his behavior. It was bad. And when I got done telling her what happened, she said to me that I owed him an amends. Whoa, 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 whoa. How did she get that out of that? I have no idea. And so obviously she missed crucial details. So I started telling her again because she missed who started it, which I always think is so important. And she stopped me cold. She said, don't repeat what you just told me. I heard you the first time. And another thing, don't you ever call me and start a conversation with what Butch said or Butch did. I am not Butch's sponsor. I am Larsine's sponsor. And for what she said and did, it was unkind and unnecessary. You took a bad situation and you made it worse. You know, I'll see you tonight. Click. End of conversation. I learned valuable lessons that day. Never call your sponsor first thing in the morning. You got all day long to think about whatever garbage she's trying to fill your head with. And never call your sponsor if you're going to see her that night at a meeting, because she's going to want to know if I follow direction. I'm a rule follower. I have no choice. But I don't put things off. I'm not a procrastinator. Butch walked in that door at 5 o'clock. I marched right up to him, and I said, I'm sorry I let your shitty attitude affect me the way that it did. And I'll try and do better in the future. Now, I know that's not the best amends you've probably ever heard, but I am here to tell you I don't know that I've ever made a better amends in my life, ever. Because it was the first time I was willing to take direction from someone who wanted me to have a life that was happy, joyous, and free. I trusted someone that cared about me. You know, and that's just been this journey, all these 41 years, this much at a time. And I can't do it by myself. I cannot do this by myself. Because I've been coming a long time, I think I know it. And I do know. I know a lot here. But knowing and doing is two different things. And the knowing will confuse me sometimes, especially when I'm trying to fix it for myself. But when I take it to you, you give me the shot at a good life. You remind me about how to do it. And it's always through love. You know, just real quick in the last minutes that I have, I want to talk about our son. you know, because, you know, that got to be an issue. I come home from an Al-Anon meeting. He's 12 years old. And Butch tells me our youngest son is Earl is 12. He says Earl has dropped acid. Butch just acts like it's, you know, he had an M&M or something. I don't know. He was pretty calm about it. You know, he goes, but don't worry. He's drinking milk and listening to Mozart. Apparently you do that. I have no idea. It doesn't sound right to me whatsoever. But Butch said, leave him alone. And I'm like, well, I'm not leaving him alone. He's freaking 12 years old. You know, so I stayed up with him all night long. And apparently having your mother in your face when you're on your first acid trip was not fun. Apparently my head was a giant balloon going like this all night long. You know, and I've never made amends for that. And I'm not gonna, just so you know that too. And, you know, and that started that roller coaster ride going. And it's not like he took out of the gate like that, but it wasn't very long, you know, before I'm standing toe-to-toe with principals because he's being expelled from school for selling drugs. He told me he didn't do it. They're framing him. You know, I mean, and I've been coming. I know the deal here. I am insane because this can't happen to my kid, because somewhere I heard you say to me that if I work this program, nothing bad will happen. And no one ever said that to me. Again, information from nowhere, because I just made it up because I'm so fearful. And let me tell you, I don't ever let you see me be fearful. I'll be pissed off. I'd much rather you see me angry than be fearful. And so our life just got progressed, started getting bad again, and I'm starting yelling and throwing things and doing all this other crap that I don't, you know, while I'm in Al-Anon 12, 13 years, just all this insanity that's going on here. And I remember finally turning myself into Carol and, you know, just how hard of a time I was having. And I told Carol, how am I supposed to be happy, joyous, and free when I have a kid who could die from this disease? And I'll never forget what Carol said to me, because it changed my life forever. Because she says, Larsine, if you're not happy, joyous, and free, then you give that kid no hope. And that is absolutely positively your responsibility to do here. And I'm not going to say it was an easy ride, because it wasn't with him. It was really, really difficult. We'd been to our South Bay Roundup, and I remember he was like 19 at the time and having lots and lots of problems. But, you know, we come home from the conference. It's our local conference. We're just full, you know, serenity's coming out of every orifice of our body. You know, you know how you are when you come home from that. And I'm very disciplined in my exercise routine. And now I haven't been on my treadmill for 3 days. So now I got to do, you know, 16 hours of treadmill work in 1 hour. So I can check it off the friggin' list. And so I go in the garage, and next to my treadmill is my son's weight bench. And on this weight bench is a driver's license. It's a woman's driver's license. It has information. I love information. And it's a woman. She's 32 years old. Her birth date's on there. She lives in Glendora, California. I immediately decide this woman has been in the house with my 19-year-old son, has had sex with him, has two kids, wants to marry him, and call me mom. I am all over this story. Information, you know. I run in the house and I show Butch the driver's license and nothing, because the man has no imagination whatsoever. You know, so I tell him what I think happened over the weekend. His eyes roll back in his head. You know, he's, you're crazy. You're a lunatic. Call Carol, you know. So I run over to the phone to call Carol, tell Carol all this stuff. And I remember Carol going to me, shut up. I mean, she rarely gave me the direction, but that day she told me to shut up. She goes, you know, there's enough crap going on in that kid's life without you making up more garbage in that head of yours. She says, you know what else? It takes just as much effort to pray for him as it does for you to think up garbage. You know, and one more time I go, never mind. Because see, I know, I just be reminded how to do it. You know, and as it turns out, a couple of days later, that kid comes in with a driver's license, my 19-year-old son, and he goes, Mom, what do you do when you find a driver's license? And I don't tell him what I do when I find a driver's license. Because it's a very, very bad example of somebody who's going to meetings, working a program, doing this deal. And I share all this with you is because it's one day at a time. You know, when things are going smooth, it's all wonderful, wonderful. But there is no guarantee. Life is on life's terms. And when you're going to love people, things are going to happen to them that are going to be scary. You know, and I'm telling you, I've been scared. I mean, there's been lots of times, lots of times. We had to ask our son to leave our house. I didn't feel like no black belt Al-Anon when I had to do that at all. But it was the right thing to do. Because we had a sober house and he couldn't be, and our house wasn't serene anymore because of his behavior. You know, and I got to learn, you know, that, you know, about unconditional love. Carol made me look up unconditional. You know what it says? No conditions. It's pretty clear, you know. But then she also told me about unacceptable behavior. You know, and that's why I can't say, people ask me, you know, in AA all the time, what's the deal with Al-Anon? Al-Anon is about love. It's about the action of love. It's about accepting people and loving them where they're at. But unacceptable behavior is unacceptable behavior. You know, and it's a fine line to go through. but you don't have to do it by yourself. And so we do it together, one day at a time. You know, I like to let you know now that when Earl, you know, I mean, Earl's been going to AA since he's 3 freaking years old with his dad. You know, it's just like, I used to say to Earl, God, what did you learn at AA meetings? He says, I learned how not to get caught. You know, I mean, you listen to what you want to listen to, you know, and I don't, you know, but when he was 36 years old, he finally turned himself into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's coming up on 10 years sober in August. And tell you, you know, that he didn't get sober because his mom's an Al-Anon, his dad's an Alcoholics Anonymous. He got sober for the same reason every single person is in this room, in AA or in Al-Anon. We say, but for the grace of God, I believe it's but for the acceptance of God's grace. You know, because God's grace is available to every single person who walks the face of this planet, is are you willing to accept that grace? You know, and to me, this is what we have in Al-Anon. There's so much grace. Are you willing to accept it? You know, and one day at a time, one moment at a time, that's just how it ends up working for us. And, you know, just to bring up real speed, you know, Butch has been doing a lot of real health issues. I mean, he's had liver cancer. A year ago, he had a subdural hematoma. That was a ride. You know, and now his liver cancer is back again. He's doing immunotherapy. I mean, it's just been some things work, some things don't work. And I tell you, there's been a lot of really scary stuff that goes on in there. You know, and one more time, I keep, you know, I know the program, but I got to do the program. You know, when he was having his subdural hematoma, and I didn't know what was going to happen, and he was in intensive care and all this crap, and I just felt so separated from God because I was so overcome with fear. I was so overcome with fear, and it was like I just couldn't find my higher power in it anywhere because I wasn't willing to accept what was going on or the worst that could happen. I wanted it to work out a way, so I was back to bargaining with God. God, please let this happen. Please let that happen. You know, and then things got worse, things got better, things got worse. And then one night I was just thumbing through some books because I was just trying to find that reconnection with my higher power. And I came across this line in this book. It says, you know what the difference is between you and God? And I was curious because I've always wondered that. And it says, God never thinks he's you. And I don't know for you guys, but it's been a real awakening for me, you know, because that's the deal, because no matter when it hits the fan, I still fall into that something I can do or say to fix somebody else. And there's not. All I can do is pray for acceptance, to be the wife he needs me to be the mother to my children that God wants me to be. And then it's going to go where it's going to go, one day at a time. That's how it's going to happen. You know, I had a friend share at a meeting the other day, too, because, you know, with this health going up and down and all these other things that are going on in our life, you know, and a friend shared at a meeting that she had heard that worry is praying for the worst thing to happen. Wrap your head around that for a minute. You know, so now every time I worry, I'm like, shit, don't do that. Because I don't want to pray for the worst thing to happen. You know, I have faith, and you guys have been proof to me over and over and over again. You know, 6 weeks ago, I got a diagnosis that I have breast cancer. And so I'm going to have a mastectomy at the end of April. And I had to wrap my head around that a little bit, but I've not been afraid of anything. I'm really pretty good about it. I'm telling everybody I'm taking my left boob here. This is its farewell tour. We're going to Hawaii for our 49th wedding anniversary from April 5th through the 15th. I'm taking it to Hawaii. I'm probably going to take it skinny dipping. Why not? Let it go out with a bang. You know, but that's the gift that you guys give to me. You know, I mean, I can sit there and fret about it and worry about it, or I can just trust in the process. You know, life is happening and life is happening, and it's going to keep on happening. But right here, right now, everything is okie dokie. You know, and there's another saying, like when Butch was in the hospital, that really hit me too. And it's, I think it's a John Lennon quote, but it says, you know, in the end, everything is going to be okay. And if it's not okay, it's not the end. You know, so one day at a time, I hope you guys enjoy your life and have a great conference. And thanks so much for having me.